From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're exploring new ways La Crosse area residents can learn more about our local and regional history. Pierre Radisson was one of the first Europeans to set foot in what is now Wisconsin. Traveling along Lake Superior in Michigan, seeing much of northern Wisconsin, and maybe even the Mississippi River. Joining us to talk about Radisson and how he's influenced present-day Wisconsin is Mark Borey, a Canadian journalist and author of a new book on Radisson's life, Bushrunner. Mark, I'll have you start out by talking a little bit about who was Radisson and why he's kind of a unique figure during this time of European settlement.
Radisson, I think, was a genius. And I'm not just saying that because I wrote a book about him. He got dumped in North America when he was about 14, 15 years old. His parents shipped him out from Paris, and I guess they never expected to see him again, and sort of inflicted him on his half-sister, who was running a little store in this teeny, tiny settlement on the St. Lawrence River. And almost immediately, he got grabbed by the Iroquois and taken to what's basically upper New York State, somewhere outside of Albany, New York, where he lived for a couple of years as an adoptee of them. And then after sort of escaping from them and going back to Europe, he ended up back in North America and spent a lot of time traveling the Great Lakes, especially up into northern Lake Michigan, southern Lake Superior, maybe as far as Mississippi, and then going back to Europe and setting up the Hudson Bay Company, which became this gigantic fur trading empire, of which he ended up with nothing from.
Yeah, and your book is incredibly detailed, both on kind of the events of Radisson's trips, but also kind of his feelings, his perceptions when he's interacting with Indigenous people or, kind of seeing new surroundings. How do we know so much about Radisson's life?
He wrote it all down. He made his two big voyages with Indigenous people, and then he defected from the French to the English. And when he got to England, the Great Plague of London in 1665 was on, and he was stuck there. He was actually stuck there for 3 years because the English were losing a war with the Dutch. And he became friends with the King of England, and the King paid him to write down the whole story. And he wrote down in really fine detail about his travels along the shore, especially along the shores of Lake Michigan and Superior, almost beach by beach, and how much he really enjoyed them. But at that time, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and northern Wisconsin were home to a lot of refugees who had been sort of blasted out of their own homelands in what's now sort of southern Michigan, southern Ontario, upstate New York, parts of Ohio, by the Iroquois, who were expanding their empire very, very quickly. So the people who were living there then were not sort of the long-term Indigenous people. They were refugees living in villages, and there were all kinds of different tribes that were living there, trying to get by, just trying to survive.
Yeah, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the Native American tribes who really helped Radisson and hosted him along the way. I know he spent time with the Menominee, which is a tribe here in Wisconsin as well.
Yeah, and he was with what we would call now the Wyandots for quite a while. The Huron and Peyton Indian refugees from southern Ontario, from Canada, who had to go up there because they'd been driven out of their homeland, and there were Ojibwe, there were Cree who were coming down from the north, there were Sioux who were living in that area, it was sort of the edge of their bison hunting territory, so they were all interacting, intermingling, and sometimes fighting, sometimes trying to get along, and Radisson and his sort of worthless brother-in-law, Groseilliers, sort of enter into this and set up a trading post at Shawemigan and become part of this great sort of movement of people and their diplomacy that was going on. And they also sold a lot of guns to everybody, which didn't really help much.
Yeah, so I think it's important to talk a little bit about, kind of what Radisson's time in North America really revolved around, which was the fur trade, specifically the popularity of the beaver fur hat in Europe. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, the importance of the beaver hat and how that became kind of a status symbol in 1600s Europe, and how that really kind of drove what some people have called European exploration, but, you know, it's really Europeans coming in to kind of set up this fur trade.
Yeah, as I wrote about it, as I researched it, I kept rolling my eyes because the whole thing is so absurd. The beaver hat was like Rolex watches today. It was basically a sign of wealth and success, and or any kind of other high end watch. And anybody who was anybody had a beaver hat. Everybody wore a hat. Every male wore a hat back then. Every woman did too. And it was, you were just considered like totally nothing if you had no hat at all. And the best hats, the ones that showed that you were a person of some quality, was the beaver hat, which is kind of goofy enough when you think of the idea of wearing a beaver on your head. And when you think of the images of the Three Musketeers, they're wearing the quintessential beaver hat, these big floppy hats that really make a person look dashing. Now, these hats weren't made of skins per se. They would ship the furs from North America, from mostly the Great Lakes area in the beginning, to Russia, and they would scrape the lint from the inside of the lower fur of the beaver and make felt out of that and make the hats out of felt. And those kinds of hats lasted until the invention of the silk top hat in the 1800s. And they would change the styles from time to time so that, of course, your beaver hat would go out of style, so you'd have to go buy another one. And I worked it out that a beaver hat was probably, in today's money, about a $2,000 investment. And some people had more than one, depending on where they wore them. And they had hunted all the beavers out of Europe, out of Russia and stuff, just at the time that the first contact was being made with indigenous people in the Great Lakes region. So all of a sudden, there was this big market for these furs from North America. And I had always thought the fur trade was about making coats and making the things that we see made out of fur, but there was almost none of that. It was all lint business. So now when I give a lecture on beaver hats, I bring my dryer filter and I pull out the lint and I say, basically, this is what the exploration and exploitation of northern North America was all about for about 200 years.
Yeah, and so what role did the indigenous people of North America kind of play in the fur trade?
They did all the work. So when you look at somebody like Radisson and his brother-in-law, so those are the two European guys who make the big trip up to the end of Lake Superior and do business with all these native people. The native people are catching the animals, skinning them, preparing the skins, but they also do all the transport because Radisson and Grosselier, the two French guys, bring basically a hardware store's worth of axes, and cooking pots, and guns, and files, and knives, and needles, and bells, and beads, and all kinds of stuff. They lug all this stuff all the way up from Montreal. So they come up the Ottawa River, which has all kinds of portages, paddle across Lake Huron, get to Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, where they finally get some decent food from the Ojibwe. And they're traveling with this great big group of indigenous people who want to be part of this trade. So when they get up to Wisconsin, and they have all these furs that they've traded from the Cree, from the Sioux, from the people in the Michigan Peninsula, from the upper Mississippi, they have to get all this stuff back to Quebec. And it takes 100 people to move these furs through basically what's a war zone of the Iroquois and other indigenous groups that want to control the trade, and they do it. So they show up with enough furs, these 100 indigenous people and the two white guys, enough to keep the colony of Quebec going. The French were actually going to just walk away from it because it had become so dangerous with all the wars around it. And Radisson and Grosselier save it with the help of 100 indigenous people. And maybe a few thousand dollars worth of hardware that they'd taken out west.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, there are several points during Radisson's, kind of journey in what is now Wisconsin and kind of the upper Midwest, there's several points where, you know, they really are kind of saved by the indigenous peoples of that area.
Oh, they were totally helpless. These were, and I'm saying that about two French guys who had spent a lot of time in the wilderness. But if it hadn't been for the indigenous people in the area, especially the Sioux come in this story. There's a whole story of their time there where they arrive, they have like lots to eat, they have lots of friends, but then things get really bad in that winter because of there's so many refugees and so many sort of political problems and sort of disputes over hunting territories and stuff. And Radisson and Groseilliers end up starving. They end up sort of cut out of the food network. And they're only saved when the Sioux arrive in the spring of 1659 with enough food to keep everybody going. And they relied on the Menominee for wild rice, which was one of the big staples of that area. And that tribe had a lock on that business. They relied on the Huron, Peyton, Wyandotte people who were around Shawamigan for corn. And to the point where Groseilliers, who was a real villain in this thing, started to hide food, thinking that if the indigenous people ever starved again, he wasn't sharing with anybody. And so they fed them, they looked after them, they gave them shelter. Now, Radisson and Groseilliers do build the first house in Wisconsin, and they probably built it. They probably built it in the area of Washburn, Wisconsin. That's where I would put my finger on it, away from the main village at Shawamigan. But they didn't live there very long because nobody was coming to them to trade, so they started to just wander. And that's why we think of them as exploring Wisconsin. Mostly they were just like looking around, trying to hook up with people and find furs. But all that was done because the indigenous people wanted to look after them and wanted to do that trade with them.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about Pierre Radisson, one of the first Europeans to visit what is now Wisconsin. We're here with Canadian author Mark Borey, who just released a new book on Radisson's life and adventures called Bushrunner. Mark, you know, we've been talking about Radisson's time in Wisconsin, but I wonder if you can maybe take a step back and talk a little bit about kind of what prompted him to take this journey.
Well, he was an adventurer, and he had lived among indigenous people for quite a while, and he was the kind of person, we do have to step back and just like talk about him for a second. First of all, he was very, very smart. He learned indigenous languages so quickly that it's startling. He learned, I think, about eight languages over his life. It would take him maybe 8-10 months to learn a language from scratch, which for someone like me who can barely speak two, that's pretty good. So he was a person who was an adventurer. He was a real swashbuckler who had no qualms about traveling anywhere. He ends up on a rock with a bunch of pirates in the Caribbean. He's at the courts of various kings in Europe. He ends up in the Arctic, where he cheats everybody that he's involved with, and the French put a price on his head. He's a brilliant writer, a very open-minded thinker. For someone of that time, it's mind-blowing. When he's traveling among the indigenous people, and I have read everything that was ever written by anybody at that time in the 1600s who went and lived among indigenous people, he's the only one who seems to like them as they are. And he says things about them as people that you never see anybody say about them being hardworking people, about the way they govern themselves, about their spirituality, and a whole bunch of other insightful things. So when he's up there, he's not some sort of babe in the woods. He is he's a very sentient, intelligent person who's also a bit of a sociopath, because he really, everything he does is sort of out for himself. And his brother-in-law, Groseilliers, is even worse. He's just a garden variety thief. And so these two guys who are kind of like a couple of con men end up among all these indigenous groups at a really pivotal time in their history. and con them into believing a whole bunch of stuff, that they're going to protect them, that they've got France behind them, that they're going to help them wage war against their enemies, that they're going to help them solve all their problems among each other. And a lot of it's just hooey. And when you read his own writings about it, you realize that these guys were pulling a tremendous con among the indigenous people, who may have understood that or may not have.
Right, because Radisson's whole journey to, you know, the Great Lakes area, to what's now Wisconsin, you know, wasn't even, kind of authorized.
No, they're smugglers. They're illegal traders. When they get back, it works out for them because they've made so much money, and money does talk in this world. But, they have no authority to promise anybody anything, especially promise military help to the Cree. Or promise the Sioux that the Sioux are going to be allies of the French forever, and all kinds of stuff that's just nonsense. They, if they had been caught by the French, they probably would have gone to prison, except for the fact they did come back from the first to save that colony. And then they keep this going. Like, Radisson keeps this going all his life, and his life. This is part of a life story that is. I think it's quite rollicking. I think it would make a great miniseries, because he takes the same kind of attitude to attacking the Dutch in the Caribbean and to the court of Louis the 14th and especially the court of Charles II, where he fits right in, because this is a whole group of people who are real con men, bounders, pirates, people who've had an awfully bumpy road. And he ends up among them and fits, like I say, fits right in.
So we still see Radisson's name in present day through the hotel chain Radisson was named after him. And there's also a town in Wisconsin named after Radisson. I wonder in what other ways we might see Radisson's time in this area kind of reflected in Wisconsin, in the upper Midwest, in this area.
I think he let people know about things like the copper mining along the coast of Lake Superior. He spends a lot of time talking about the copper that he saw as he made the trip, and how the indigenous people used it and how they knew about it. At that point, it wasn't worth mining for the French, because they would have carried all the way to Europe, and copper wasn't worth that much. But eventually, I think that writing by people like Radisson and Schoolcraft and others who traveled that part of Lake Superior were really important to the development of the shore of Lake Superior. He leaves us with a very important description of the Sioux, who become a plains people with horses. We see them through his eyes as people who are bison hunters or buffalo hunters, but they're not horse people yet. So I think that's one of the more valuable things he's left behind in terms of knowing the history of the Mississippi and the plains area of Wisconsin. He gets the credit for discovering the Mississippi, and maybe he did. He certainly knew about it, and he probably told people that the Mississippi was there. Even if he didn't see it, he would have known about it, because it was something that he would have been told about. He made two trips where he was pretty close to the Mississippi if he never got there. One was with the Iroquois in the Ohio Valley, and the other was with the Sioux. So that's, I think, fairly important. When his writing was discovered in the 1880s, and his writings to Charles II were lost, and they turned up when they were about to be made into wallpaper in the 1880s and published. And the historians of Wisconsin and Minnesota really seized on Radisson as sort of the first European in that region, and wrote a lot about him. So basically the best writing of Radisson was in the 1880s up until about 1930. And then he just sort of gets tossed in among Canadians. For some reason, he becomes a Canadian explorer, which is really quite odd, because he rarely travels in Canada, frankly. Anytime he was in Canada, he was desperate to get out, which sort of describes many Canadians today, I'm afraid. And his connection to that area became sort of the founding myth of Minnesota and Wisconsin. And so why we have Radisson hotels is because Radisson was considered the founder of the Minneapolis area, Minneapolis-St. Paul, And when somebody bought a hotel years and years ago, they built a hotel, they named it the Radisson Hotel, and that became a chain of hotels. So I could never find any instance where he ever slept at any hotel anywhere. But we know him from the hotel chain. I have a boat, and when I tie my boat up, the cleat says Radisson on it. And his name seems to get used a lot to sell things, which is kind of funny because he was a bit of a salesman himself. And, you know, the hotel chains are nice. There's an icebreaker, Canadian icebreaker called the Radisson. He's fairly big in Canada because of the Hudson Bay Company, which was one of those things like the East India Company that opened up areas for colonization. And it was his idea to start it, and then rich people in England took it forward. So he gets a lot of credit for that in Canada. Canada's claim to a lot of the West, a lot of the plains, is based on the Hudson's Bay Company. So that's pivotal to Canada's sort of shape as a nation, that Radisson had that idea. He's so connected to so many places. And Minneapolis, St. Paul is one where he's well-remembered. And I think there's some memory of him along Lake Superior, and I think there's an awful lot of descendants of him around there, if you know what I mean.
Mark Borey is a Canadian journalist and author of Bush Runner, a new book on the life of Pierre Radisson, one of the first European explorers in the area that's now Wisconsin. He joins us today to talk about who Radisson was and how his trip to Wisconsin in the upper Midwest has influenced our region's history. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, including our conversation on the Enduring Families Project, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.